Good afternoon, everyone. The afternoon of the fourth day of 4 days of very hard sitting. I must say, I'm impressed. I think everyone is doing really well, and it's not easy. I have a whole page full of stuff to say that I think I'm going to say. I'm not sure. because I want to talk about Zazen itself. And it connects with what Carolyn was talking about at lunch today about speaking. Talking. It's not about talking too much, but talking at all. That it is leaking. That as we sit, we're building up energy in our body. Actual physical energy, dharmic energy. You may not have noticed it, but as time goes on, you will notice you can walk stronger and you can move better and you can even make better decisions. That your body builds up its intelligence as you sit. It's wisdom. And talking leaks it. So, of course, in our ordinary everyday life, we very much need to connect with each other. I read very recently somebody's theory that speaking developed was developed by little children in Africa in one of the original ancient peoples who lived thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago, that for a long time people talked to themselves. They just carried themselves around and they made nods and gestures, but nobody thought to say anything. But little kids started playing and saying, oh, look at this, I think... We'll call this a weed. A weed. It's like, weed, weed. And it's such a good word. It's so fun to say. And so little by little, people began to identify and speak about what they saw and related to, which was a wonderful thing in many, many ways. And in other ways, it was a leakage. And so discriminating between those is exquisitely important for all of us. Buddha has a tremendous amount to say about speaking. And right speech is one of the ways to live that he pointed out. Right speech meaning doing no damage. And though it's an invisible thing, even those early Cro-Magnon peoples could realize how damaging a cruel, mean word could be. So that's a powerful leakage on both sides. So Buddha was very strong about absolutely saying, don't do this. But it's also true in sitting. We don't do this. Just because it's a gift to ourselves and to others. So sometimes it seems kind of strange, you know, to say shut up and sit down. But it's a present to us all to be able to do this. And you'll find that you are deeply, more deeply connected as you do so. We become more intimate this way. You must be feeling it already. So, our zazen is called shikantaza. Sometimes. That's our official Zen way of talking about it. It means, she means only or just, and kan means, or it means just, only. She means only, and kan means just. Sitting, zazen. So it seems very, very, very simple. And in essence, it is. And in essence, it is a concentration somewhat like the concentration that we develop in our everyday life. So it's familiar to us. When we concentrate on doing any job that takes any kind of attention, we're putting all of our focus on that and making that, really, we disappear as we do it. Artists know this. As soon as you pick up the brush and begin to paint, you just lose yourself, we say. I lose myself in my painting and my writing. I'm not there anymore. I don't have to be there because I'm doing this thing. So that, too, is a samadhi, a practice. And in Zen, it's recommended that we all have a kind of practice like that. Tea ceremony is a perfect example of that. That also, they're not speaking. It's just quietly focused on expressing the wholeness of all things with every gesture. And yet it's not special. It's just one human person doing something. It isn't woo-woo. It's just as it is, just nice. Nice as we like to be. And how often we are not. So having a practice is a wonderful thing to cultivate. Arranging flowers. We have beautiful flower arrangements around here now. One. Really pretty. That's an expression. There are whole schools of flower arranging in Japan. Also silent. You don't have to say anything. You just nod to the flowers, arrange them. And when they're dead, you save them and then have a funeral for them at the end of the year. They do that at Hokoji. So the samadhi of everyday life is called Taju Samadhi. And with our own wide awake life and mind, we practice Taju Samadhi with mindfulness. That's what mindfulness means. It means staying awake in whatever we're doing. Even if we're talking, even if we're whatever. But when we sit down, we're gathering energy. And we're gathering it for the benefit of others, for the benefit of being able to connect with the world and to see the world and to see our life as it really is and not be so confused. That's why it's important to have a practice that happens every single day. You can't just sit down and get a hit of Zazen and get up and run around and forget about it for 3 weeks and then think, oh, I should sit. It doesn't work like that. And as you notice, sitting for 20 or 40 or 50 minutes during the day, every day, isn't the same as sitting all day long or all 4 days long or all 7 or 10 or 20 days long. So there are many permutations of this practice that it's very important to know about and to offer yourself to if you can. And I know people's lives are so complicated. People who have families, especially. There are some wonderful practitioners who have families who can't be here because their kids are home and they have to take care of them. Koban always said, that's your practice. That's probably the hardest one because you feel, as Ying was saying the other day about her life, you're so torn. You want to be with your kids and you want to be in the Zendo just about equally. And to find a place to bring that together is a huge, huge thing. So people often ask, why do we do this? What is this? What's, you know, if you tell people what you're doing, which I don't recommend unless they're really close friends, because they won't understand. If you tell them, they say, well, why are you doing it? And usually you just have to throw up your hands and say, well, gee, I really can't say. I kind of just have to do it. What is this? Why do we do this? And Dogen says, because we're like this. That's what we're like. We practice because we've always been like this. He says, enlightenment is endless and beginningless and outside of time. That although we feel bound by time and space, yet he says we have 1 foot in eternity. In our contemporary practice, there are a lot of practicers who address this by talking about the now. Eckhart Tolle is one of them. The now. That sounds very esoteric, but it just means this place right now, which is totally timeless. Has no beginning and no end. This place, right now, right here. And the remarkable thing about us is how quickly we leave it. How fast we leave it. Even in a Dharma talk, we start thinking about other things or start feeling the bugs around us or something and forget or think about what we're going to do next or what's for dinner. There's so many things going on in our minds. And yet all the time, we're right here. Right now. So it's essential to know both sides and to live both sides. It's essential to take your sitting out with you, out of the Zendo. As Carolyn said, take it into the kitchen. Definitely take it into the kitchen. It's part of the Zendo. But the trees and the forest and the residence house and the dining table, it's all Zendo, Zendo. Your car, too. And the bus you ride. And the house you live in. So much of our life is about noticing, paying attention to where we really are, how we are. We're so filled with feelings and thinkings that often we just live by those feelings and thinkings without realizing what's happening. What's really going on? And something important is always going on. We really have a kind of job to do. There's something in the world that's very much ignoring this. It's so easy to go like this and not try not to see what it really is, how it is for us, to keep our own agenda going, because of course we have to keep our own agenda going. We have to get there. We have to get there. So it's important to study where there is and what the getting is. What is your aspiration? Is it healthy? Is it wholesome? Is it kind? We live in a world that is so peculiar. It seemed peculiar to me when I was a little girl and they told me that there was a war going on. And I said, "What's a war?" And they said, "Oh, those bad people over there, that we have to kill them." And I said, "Oh my God, you mean, no. How could..." And Uncle Edwin is going over there, and he's going to wear a uniform, and he'll have a special hat, and he will have this job. They will give him a gun, and he will go and kill these bad people. And then we turned on the radio in the evening sometimes, and this terrible voice came through it. This terrible ranting voice that went on and on. It was screaming. It was Hitler's voice. That's how old I am. So there are some things that are very, very hard to understand about our human life. Hard to grok. How do we do this? Why do we do this? And contemporary life is heating up, it seems, and our way with each other becomes more and more, I will use despicable. Not because it's bad, but because it's so unhelpful. It's so damaging. And you can't, so people aren't going out. Well, some people are going out and shooting each other and killing each other, but the most damage is being done with words. And so we all are infected by it. We're all soaked up with whatever happens in the world. I feel I still have the Second World War in me. Not to speak of the Korean War and the Vietnam War, etc., etc., etc. So part of studying the self is studying where the self lives, what the context is for our life, and working out a healthy way to navigate without doing harm. Or the least harm. Paula talked yesterday beautifully about the precepts. We use the precepts to be aware of how to do no harm as best we can, even though we can't perfectly keep them and we wouldn't even want to be perfect. But to do our best. So Zazen itself brings us into some kind of relationship with all of this. And it's painful, not just physically painful, but just how painful the psychic energy is that we carry with us. And often express. And even if we don't express it outwardly, we express it inwardly. So coming to terms with those things, coming to terms with this Paju Samadhi, you could say, learning how to live our life in terms of the Samadhi that we develop in the Zendo. Very, very important. So I think that's enough. That's not everything I wrote here, but I don't think that's too many words. Are there questions? Victor?
talking about samadhi and concentration. Is it important to do one thing at a time?
Yeah.
I notice sometimes it just seems pretty hard. Like I notice at the when we do the meal ceremony, we chant and we're passing out food, and everybody kind of like stutters and trying to do two things at once. That's what I think in my head. But then, I think there's lots of times when we, you know, when we have meals with other people, we talk and eat at the same time.
Yes.
But you can't do it as well. And then
that's right.
You forget, you're not really paying attention to the food if you're talking.
It's true. Yeah. It's nice to eat quietly with people and talk after.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And to memorize the sutras.
Memorize so you don't... Oh, that's the truth.
Not so hard.
I had another follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
What about doing work? And I know a lot of people do work and they have their earbuds in and listening to music. Is that a is that not such a good thing to do?
Well, in terms of doing two things at once, I think it is. I think the best way to hear music is to really be there with it. But it had a function of lightening the sense of effort for people. But it's a distraction. It's another way of doing this. Not actually paying attention to what's going on, but just enough to do what's being done, but not the whole of it. So, it's a choice.
Just as a follow-up, I asked a Zen teacher, do you think that sitting Zen is helpful to prevent Alzheimer's dementia? And the answer was no, because in a sense we're not holding on to any thoughts, we're just going through. And I know from memory class things that I've read and gone to, you want to make associations, you know, like one is sun, so if you need to buy a roll of toilet paper, you'll have toilet paper around this, you know, dramatic big things. So I was wondering if you knew anything more about this in terms of letting thoughts go by and not being helpful for concentration in a way, maybe causing more likelihood of dementias.
Oh, I don't think that's a danger. Zazen is not dangerous in that way. I don't think there's a cure for Alzheimer's at this point, and nobody knows what's creating it. But it's probably a chemical thing that's going on in the body, some kind of imbalance, just like all the other imbalances. You know, there are many, many of them, inflammations of one kind or another, that we all end up suffering. So Alzheimer's is one kind of that. But our mind has many mansions, you could say. There are many, many aspects and experiences and lives of it, you could say. And there is a point in Zazen where you aren't thinking. Non-thinking, that beyond thinking, is a true experience. And it can happen to anybody at any time. And it's not Alzheimer's. It's more like the Dharma, the truth of things. My favorite story is my own story of after a very intense session, I got up in the morning and looked out the window. And in the leaves, right outside the window, as close as Emily is to me, was this remarkable bird. I just couldn't believe it, that he was right there in my yard. It was so beautiful. It had this yellow around its eye, very bright eye. It was dark and very upright. And it had this sort of dark kind of orange chest and this beautiful stance with this yellow feet and legs like this and scratching in the ground. And I just looked and looked. And I was so awestruck, and way in the back of my mind was this tiny voice that said, "Robin." What? So, it's what happens. It's the truth that we just, like those little kids way back in Cro-Magnon times, they made up names for these remarkable things that we're confronting every single day. And we get so caught up with the names of them, the words for them, that we forget what it really is. So.
May I just say a wee word about Alzheimer's?
Yes, please.
Can't remember it. No. the first person that Suzuki Roshi got to know was called Della Gortz, and she helped me be at Zen Center. I was homeless when I went into Zen Center, and I became her housekeeper. And then at the end of her life, I became her caregiver, and she developed Alzheimer's. And I'd never heard that woman say a wrong word about anyone. She was absolutely my hero, and suddenly she was grumpy and unhappy and totally miserable at times. The only thing that gave her peace and joy was I'd say, "Let's sit together, Della." And we'd both sit there, and she was so happy because it was okay not to know and not to remember what things were. So if anybody has a relative or a friend that has Alzheimer's, it actually gives great peace to be able to sit, because it no longer matters if you can think what things are or not. So it's actually a lovely thing to share with people that have Alzheimer's or similar things.
Thank you for that. David?
On the building of energy, I'm a little of two minds about whether one ought to cultivate it or do nothing.
You can't cultivate it.
Well,
you can sit.
Yes.
And stay where you are.
So anything, but so the answer is then don't do anything.
Well, there are lots of techniques if you want to go into all of that, but really that's kind of a waste of time. If you're in a sesshin, the best way is not to pull out all the techniques, because then you've got an agenda and you've got a goal, and that just keeps you stuck. The bigger the goal, or the more goal you have, the stucker you get.
I'd like to prioritize my stuckness by emphasizing
I know.
So it's back to the secondary and tertiary level.
Yeah. Best way is to put your mind in your hands. Just rest your mind. Let it rest. You know, stay upright, in alignment, they say. Just feel yourself aligned, both vertically and horizontally. You're right here. Boom. Right here. Boom. Right here. So if you rest against your belly and hold your hands there, and just put your mind there, and don't worry about things. Don't worry about how you're doing or what you're going to do next or what happened 5 days ago that you're still carrying with you. Forget about it. Just for the time being, and see what happens. It feels scary. We feel like we're controlling things as we think things. We feel like we can keep it all together. So it takes a little courage just to let your mind rest and be what it wants to do and be. It needs to rest. It's tired. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. You were talking about healthy aspirations, and this area of the world in which, you know, another part of my life is taking place seems to be very concerned about having an impact. And there's something very egoic about that, and something that doesn't feel true to me. And it feels very different for me to being of service. And so one thing for me that was personally quite disorienting about getting some level of insight of what is true for me is exactly that. But that doesn't quite ring the bell anymore. And so healthy aspirations, it has become entirely different and defined for me, you know?
Yes.
And I wonder if you could elaborate on that a little bit further. Because it's something I run into a lot, you know, with people of my age.
Of course. Well, we say this arrogant-sounding thing that we vow to save all sentient beings. Now, that's the essence of our Zen Buddhist practice. We are going to save all beings. What does that mean? It does not mean that we're on a high place and we're going to take on those lowly sods and make something out of them. It's not like that. It's the opposite, actually. So we actually say in the Bodhisattva vow that we vow to be with all things, because that's really what saving means. It means to bring your whole self together with whatever you meet, whether it's a rock or a person. And just let it be what it is, to be accepting, first of all, before you can decide what it's going to be, what it tells you it is. And then you know how to act. Usually we act by seeing something and thinking we know already what it is, and then we go for it. So saving all beings is being willing to listen to the other, to accept the presence of the other, even though they may be a so-called enemy, that still, that's the universe expressing itself in a particular way that you need to really be carefully knowing about. And you can't know if you're just filled with hatred and ideas about it. You have to slow down and listen and know what it is that you're facing and find the truth of it. And sometimes an enemy turns out to be something entirely different. So it means that we develop clarity that way, which is really important. And then we can take on any kind of job. You can work in the tech companies and meet all the people who are working there and meet them honestly and listen to them. And because we sit, we carry sitting as itself. So we don't have to say anything about it, but people will feel it. They do feel it. We all know that. They feel it even though we don't want to say anything about it, because we live in a certain way. So it's all service, really. It's all serving the altar, serving Buddha and Dharma and Sangha. It just doesn't look like that.
I have a question related to your Robin story. I have that experience as well, I'm sure many people do. And when I was little, I learned the names of plants very early. And when I came here to the U.S. when I was 18, I didn't know the names of plants anymore. Not only I didn't know the names in English, but actually the plants themselves are entirely different.
Oh, of course.
So I have this strange understanding that I couldn't have a relationship with them if I didn't know the words to describe it. And I also realized that if I didn't know someone's name, it's actually hard for me to have a relationship with them.
Yes.
That I can communicate with them without words, but there's a level of talking where it's actually really difficult to talk with someone in a real way without knowing what they're called.
That's true. That's a very good point. Yeah.
So my question is, for me, I do not prefer to talk. I know that about myself. I'd much rather walk through the woods not knowing the names of anything. However, I can't carry my whole life that way.
Right.
So how do I have that relationship and have the relationship at the level of language?
You know, it's hard because it's an extroverted culture. And so everyone is expected to be able to speak and speak up in some kind of eloquence. And the eloquent people are the ones who actually sort of hold the power. You know, they're the ones who can drive everything. And those of us who are introverts have a real hard time finding a way to, exactly as you say, to finding a way to speak up and have some effect. And it, if you're a woman, it's even 5 times, 10 to 100 times harder, because then you have that other thing going on as well. It is really, really tough to be heard. So I try to encourage people I know to listen and to help develop a kind of new culture where we are able to listen to each other as well as just drive through with ideas and thoughts, to make not people's ideas but people's being and essence and meaning the most important, and not what I think or you think, that those things are very by the way, especially in community. Community is a living thing. It's a living body. And so it's essential to have some way of truly meeting, looking into one another's eyes and bearing one another's grief. That's the most important thing. Otherwise, there's no point in being together. We might as well go out and walk in the woods. So I had the same thing about the flowers. I came from Missouri. There are different flowers here. But we can't walk in the woods. We all have an important thing to do. We need to connect. Without it, we're lost. And I think truly lost. So thank you. That's a very good question.
Hey, should I move over so you can see me?
Yeah, that would help.
So I don't really have a question. Maybe if you could just comment, about my practice. I kind of would love to just get some advice or your perspective on it. So, one, I love the format of the session. I have been connecting really deeply with just kind of surrendering to kind of the form, you know, which allows you just to kind of like rest and kind of just give up everything else, right? Just surrender everything else, as long as you have like kind of like the very simple instruction of, you know, how to behave and what to do, and it's all very polite and very beautiful. And I've had, you know, and it's been great because also, like, I've never had to stare at a wall for so long. I normally normally meditate with my eyes closed. And so I figured, you know, kind of I'd give it a good college try, and I've been staring at a wall. And it's been interesting, but you just seeing what that kind of brings up, you know, kind of, you know, looking at a wall and looking at the stucco and kind of like little pictures start to emerge.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they do.
Yeah. And, you know, and then kind of like, you know, my eyes will kind of adjust and I'll kind of look up here and then look down there and look up here, you know, kind of reframing a bit my perspective. But I have these moments, you know, of clarity when, you know, it's obviously it's very difficult to describe, but you know, I can kind of describe it best when, you know, you're sitting and you no longer have any expectation of what I'm supposed to be gaining from this experience. And also, I'm no longer waiting for the bell.
Yes. What a mercy.
No, and it's like, because then it's like you're finally right. You're resting in kind of your ordinary mind.
Yes.
That word. So, obviously, the problem is, like, the moment you experience that, you just go, and you try to catch it, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, that's been my constant battle this entire time. And I've kind of come up with the description that, like, it's kind of like trying to catch a mosquito in a dark room, you know? That, like, all of the while I can be, like, trying to look for this thing, and then it's only when I'm, like, really still, there's, like, here it comes, and I hear it, and it lands on me, and I, you know, and I try to get it, and then it's, like, I'm back to looking for it again.
You have to let the mosquito bite you.
Yeah, I know, right? So, well, I guess, like, what was your experience, you know, with your practice? Because I feel like the part of it, it feels like there's that moment of tranquility or peace, you know, that kind of ordinariness.
Yes.
And then it's so easy to just immediately get lost in, like, trying to get it back, you know, I find is the problem. You know, it's like that you have this kind of memory of what that state was like, you know, and then it's like, oh, no, now I'm trying to get it again, you know. Anyways, that's been my experience for past 4 days.
To be free from clinging, we must be free from greed.
Right.
So you can't want it.
I know. Well, I totally hear that. But it seems like sometimes it feels very difficult to know how to almost, like, let go of your hand.
You can't.
You know what I mean?
You can't. You just have to keep going.
Yeah.
Trust it. Trust yourself. Trust your own intuition about it. His wisdom. And we've only sat 4 days. Keep sitting. Well, before we go, I want to introduce Michael Newhall, who some of you may not know, who is the abbot of this temple and has been working away in the garden, unseen by most of us, and is gracing us with his presence.